Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Right, good evening. Good evening and welcome to the LSE. My name's Neil Lee. I'm a professor of economic geography. I'm also pleased to be involved with the LSE Festival. And I'm really pleased to welcome you here tonight, both online and in the room, in the Grand Hall, to the final event of our LSE Festival, which has been on the theme of how to save the planet. Now, this is our final event, and by tradition, we save the best till last, with apologies to those of you who are involved in earlier events. Essentially, this year, we've been asking the question, how to save the planet? And there's been sort of students going around the school, sort of interviewing people, interviewing often the famous people who've been speaking as part of the festival about, you know, how can we do that? And one of the consistent themes, one of the things they've said the most, is that the way that we can save the planet is by cooperating, by doing things together, by breaking down some of the sort of boundaries which we've seen. So some of the fantastic speakers we've had this week, from Nadia Calvino, Mariana Mazzucato, and Adam Met, they've all said that collaboration, working together, is really important. So our challenge tonight is to try and work out how we could do that. We're going to talk about the things that divide us as a society, what it's going to take for us to overcome this polarization, identity politics, animosity, and how we can work together to save the planet. So this is quite a big ask. It's a tough question, but we have a superb panel to be answering it. We have Denise Barron, who's a political psychologist, researcher, and strategist. She's an alumna of LSE, now a visiting fellow here, and she has over a decade of experience working on political campaigns in the US, UK, and Europe, and she has a book out next year. Okay, so we'll have to welcome you back. Then we have Nick Coldry. He's a sociologist of media and culture, professor emeritus and professorial research fellow at the LSE. His books include, most recently, The Space of the World, Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media, and What If It Can't? And Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. And then finally, we have Nish Kumar, a stand-up comedian currently on tour with his show, Angry Humor from a Really Nice Guy. I mean, he's sort of kind of everywhere. I had a great afternoon watching his stand-up performances on YouTube. Please keep it clean, because we are in a university. alongside stand-up, Nish co-hosts the hugely popular podcast Pod Save the UK, and he's a frequent voice and face across both television and radio. With apologies to Nick, if you are on social media, you can use the hashtag LSEFestival. Whatever sort of, you know, whether you're using Blue Sky, X, or whatever, or if you're posting AI-generated content on LinkedIn. Please, would you put your phones on silent so you don't disturb the event? And the event is being recorded, and hopefully, and we always have to say this disclaimer, hopefully it will be made available as a podcast and video, subject to no technical difficulties. Now, we're going to have interventions from each of our three panelists, and then there will be the chance for you guys to ask questions to the panel. So if you're online, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature. Please make sure you include your name and affiliation, and at some point I will get an iPad and I'll read them out. And for those of you here in the theatre, I'll let you know when we open the floor for questions, but please do think of questions as we go. Then after the event, because it is the final event of a fantastic festival, we will be able to have a celebratory drink to mark the end of the festival week, and you'll also be able to buy a copy of Nick's latest book, The Space in the World, and get it signed. So we're going to go Nick, Denise, Nish, about sort of short interventions, and then we'll open it up to a little bit of debate and then some questions. So Nick, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Neil, for the introduction. And I do use social media, I admit it. And I have done for a long time, and I'm still doing it. The reason I wrote my last book, which is really about social media, it's not about climate change, was because I was thinking, how can I, as a social theorist, I'm not an environmental scientist. I don't do that. I don't have that knowledge. How can I contribute to this debate about climate emergency as someone who doesn't have that technical knowledge? Well, I'm a social theorist. For me, the question is, how do we have to get society fixed so that we can answer the question of acting together for saving the planet? That's why I wrote this book. And from my point of view, there's absolutely no way we can move forward, build more collaboration, without looking honestly and directly at the mess we are in and what caused it. And there are many factors obviously involved. It's not just social media. So there's rising inequality, which is a scandal. There's the collapsing confidence in governments and whether they're even remotely competent to do what they have to do. But there's another factor, I believe, which is the changing nature of social space itself. I know that sounds really abstract, the sort of things just academics talk about. But what I mean are literally the changes to the spaces we live in, our social space, that have flowed from all of us using digital spaces, commercial social media. And those changes are, for me, the root of all those different specific accelerating social problems we're all talking about. That's the root, the change in space itself. Because, my book argues, we as humanity made a fundamental error around about 20 years ago when we allowed businesses that, of course, operate for profit to redesign our social world and to exploit that redesign for profit. That was a category error. And just imagine, to convince you why this is a category error, why this is completely wrong. Imagine if around about 22 years ago, someone had come up to you and said, well, I know you're worried about some of that bad stuff out there online, but you do like being connected, don't you? And you say, well, yeah, I do. I do like being connected. Then this person says, well, I built this black box. I'm going to call it a platform, but it's basically a black box. You go into it and you just come inside and you're easily then going to be connected by my software to all your friends and lots of interesting people you don't even know yet. But there is just one condition, that I'm going to have to track you as you do stuff inside the black box because I'm going to make some money from advertising. Well, if they'd said that to you, you might have thought, well, okay, that's probably all right. And then this person said, well, that's great, because there are just a few other terms and conditions I also need you to accept. You see, because for my business model to work, and you want that to happen, don't you, I need to be able to make sure that any bad stuff that's out there online gets to you as soon as possible, right? You got that. So because when you jump up and down on that bad stuff, that'll make me money with the advertisers, okay? And if other people are jumping up and down at other bad stuff, I'm also gonna send that through to you as quickly as possible. Is that okay? And in fact, if you aren't jumping up and down, well, I'm gonna keep nudging you until you do feel tempted to jump up and down at whatever's in front of you in my black box. And when, of course, when you do jump up and down, I'm gonna make sure that other people know that too, so that they can start jumping up and down with you. Is that okay? And in fact, my whole business model, this person's saying, depends on everyone jumping up and down as much as possible, almost all the time. The technical term, by the way, is engagement, which probably means, I'll be honest, getting people a bit more angry with each other, maybe even a bit more polarized from each other. But hey, this is just how I'm gonna be making money. Is that okay? I think then you would probably have said, I'm not sure I like the sound of this. I don't like the sound of this at all. But of course, no one told you any of that in 2004. They didn't tell you any of that. Even though Facebook's patents and designs, if you go back to look closely at those patents, including ones written by a certain author called Mark Zuckerberg, they designed a world in which all what I've just described would happen. They designed it from the start. And of course, at that time, we all just got along connecting, as I did. We enjoyed it at first. But when the problem started emerging, some of us started to be tempted to join maybe a different black box, or maybe not be in any black box at all. The platform said, oh no, you can't do that. You can't do that because you started in this black box, so that means you've got to finish in this black box. You can't move your contacts. You can't move your nice photos or your comforting chats. You can't move them anywhere because they're locked in here now in this black box, because they're our business asset. You can't move them. And then, of course, it's important to recognize that social media engineers were not evil people. The problem was that they messed with the wiring of the social world without even knowing that's what they were doing. It's like a car mechanic saying, well, I'm good at connections. I can try my hand at open heart surgery too. I can link things up. Why not try it? That's what they did. So they didn't know what the harm was going to be until they started finding it out. And this is my summary of the sort of mess we're in. And the root of it is we allowed, or rather governments allowed, it wasn't, we weren't consulted. Governments, and particularly the US government, allowed businesses to exploit the social air that we breathe. And that was a mistake. And that's the root of the increasingly toxic nature of our societies and our politics. But we really, therefore, do not have much choice but to face up to this error. There is no future in not being honest about this. This is the core of the problem. But the good news is that we can face up to it because there are actually alternatives really out there. There are really non-profit social media which already exist. They're not very popular yet because the regulators are not allowing them to get to you. Because you can't move your contacts there. But they could do that. Those non-profit media exist. The ideas for designing social media to manage it on a scale that's much closer to communities exist. It's called the Fediverse, which some of you may be aware of. And we already have real-world examples in Holland and Canada and elsewhere of how people can be encouraged to move on to these less toxic platforms if only they can do it within the supportive context of the real-world communities that they know that aren't yet toxic. And thank God there are still some communities that are not yet toxic. So why not use them as a starting point for joining these much healthier platforms? So the message of my book is that if we can start facing up to the problem as it actually is, not as we want it to be, and working then together to build better ways of connecting, which we can do, then we will be in a position to start taking on what, after all, are the real existential challenges of our time, which are not to do with guys in Silicon Valley. They are about the future of our climate. They are about the continuing violence of men against women. They are about the attempt to reverse 100 years of human rights. That's really what we should be paying attention to. But I'd like to get us to the point we can actually start doing that. Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. And perfectly on time as well, which is, you know, deserve another round of applause for that.
Great. Thanks so much, Neil. And thank you, thank the organizers for inviting me to be a part of this event. I'm really proud to be a part of this intellectual community, not only because the dedication that LSE scholars like Nick and students here have to critical thought, to nuance, to rigor, but also because of the intellectual heritage of this specific institution. For over a century, this place, the actual land that we're on right now, has been a globally influential gathering place of big thinkers, people who are trying to answer the biggest questions facing the world. When I think about how this event today is yet another example of this very long tradition, I'm really grateful to be with you. So I'm Denise Barron, as Neil mentioned. I'm a political researcher and strategist. I first arrived at LSE in 2015, and I was coming off a series of a number of political campaigns in the U.S. Happy to chat about those over the drinks and my various losses on the electoral stage. And I realized I wanted to better understand what really drives political attitudes and behavior. So during my master's, PhD, and sort of subsequent collaboration with scholars here, I've learned how to dig into data, design research, interrogate the social and psychological forces that shape how we think. Alongside that, I continued advising political leaders, which is the primary focus of my career right now. And it's worth saying at this stage that I'm here representing my own views, my personal views, my research, and not that of any organization I've previously worked for or currently work for. Just a classic disclaimer. So my research over the last decade has addressed questions like, what shapes the way we vote, what's driving polarization, and why is nostalgia such a powerful political and cultural force? So a big question, big picture question, like how to save the planet, is exactly the kind of challenge I'm excited to think about. And of course, it's always nice to have a small scale, low stakes question to focus on. What's it gonna take to save the planet? Something easy and I softball to get things going. So I'm really looking forward to see how Nish, Nick and I basically solve everything tonight. So the question at hand. As posed by the organizers, this isn't only about our physical planet, the Earth, our natural surroundings, and our ability to live here, but primarily about our social environment, our communities, our nations, our ability to live with each other. The issues facing our planet are material ones, but also social and relational problems. So my approach focuses on the fundamental aspects of our psychology, of our human nature. My approach to saving the planet focuses on understanding our nature, accepting our nature, and working with, not against, our nature. So first, in terms of understanding our nature, the longer I research what shapes our political cognition and behaviors, the more I see evidence that tribalism, us versus them thinking, that general sense of groupishness, that's not a flaw in human psychology, it's a feature, and even could be a benefit. My husband often says that if I had a catchphrase, it would be that we're small group primates. I love to talk about this. We evolved in small groups, our survival depended on bonding with us and distinguishing ourselves from them. That instinct hasn't gone away. It shapes the way we interpret information, how we form identities, and how we make political decisions today. This groupishness helps us build cooperation and belonging, but it also fuels division. If we don't understand how powerful it is, it'll keep being surprising when collective action breaks down along group lines. If we want to tackle global threats, we have to start by recognizing that people don't process information as neutral individuals. They process them as a member of a group, as a part of a tribe. So if we don't understand this part of ourselves, then we'll continually be derailed by factionalism that is simply a part of who we are as human beings, as small group primates. Second, accepting our nature. And this is the hardest part. In places like LSE, we value evidence and rationality. It can be uncomfortable to accept that human behavior isn't always driven by facts. By rejecting these aspects of our psychology, it doesn't make them disappear. It just makes us less effective at building coalitions and creating belonging. Take nostalgia, one of my favorite topics. Nostalgia is actually the focus of my forthcoming book with Dr. Sandra Obradovich, who is also a part of LSE. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science. Many people dismiss nostalgic rhetoric as manipulative, as something that guy does, as something the other side does. But nostalgia is a widespread psychological phenomenon, and it can take many, many forms. We can be nostalgic about different eras, concepts, even values. For instance, over 80% of the British public would like to go back to a time when we had a sense of togetherness, when we had a sense of community spirit. That's not flawed thinking. That's a signal about what people value and what they're missing in their lives. When people feel uncertain or threatened, they look to the past, not because they're irrational, but because they're searching for reassurance, identity, a sense of continuity. We look to the past for an example of when things weren't this hard. We look for evidence that we can survive this hardship, and we talk about it with each other as a way to emotionally and powerfully signal what it is that we hold dear and what we want for our shared future. Even the way I opened my remarks, talking about LSE's heritage, traditions, our history, this was an appeal to that same instinct, to our shared history. Perhaps it resonated with some of you. If it didn't, that's fine. But if it did, that's kind of the point. These emotional connections are not weaknesses. They're how we build shared meaning and collective identity. If we dismiss them, we're not rising above our human nature. We're disconnecting from each other. So third, and finally, working with and not against our nature. Once we understand and accept how people think and feel, we can start designing solutions that actually connect, that actually resonate. Take climate change. It's a profound challenge, but it's also abstract, long-term, and faceless. It usually lacks that us versus them structure. That makes it hard to sustain the attention of small group primates and maintain collective action between us. And so when climate has been brought into the culture war, the dividing lines have been drawn in the most divisive way possible. But if we approach the same issue through the lens of people's most salient threats and pressures, like rising energy costs, economic insecurity, geopolitical instability, then it becomes more immediately felt for more people. Instead of leading with climate change as an environmental obligation, we can position domestic renewable energy as a way to reduce bills, bring energy bills down, strengthen the national security, and increase independence. Renewable energy and a solution to climate change therefore becomes about national sovereignty. It's a solution to big existential threats, which do have a clear adversary to unite the country around. Now that issue isn't abstract. It's about us. It's about our pocketbooks, our finances, our families, our country, and our shared future. That's what it can look like to work with human nature, not to manipulate it, but to respect it. To design policies and narratives that align with how people actually experience the world. Because the reality is, the challenges we face, like climate change, polarization, global instability, these require large-scale cooperation, like it's been brought up throughout the week, it sounds like. And we struggle to sustain, not because we lack information, but because we often ignore the social and psychological foundations that bond people together and make cooperation possible. If saving the planet is both a material and a social challenge, then our task isn't just technological or economic, it's human. It's about building coalitions, teams, groups that feel meaningful, identities people can actually belong to, narratives that are strong enough to hold people together to sustain that large-scale cooperation. We simply cannot solve 21st century problems with an incomplete understanding of human nature. But if we're willing to understand it, accept it, and work with it, then many of the barriers that we face today stop looking like barriers and start looking like opportunities. And that makes progress feel possible, not in spite of who we are, but because of it. Thank you.
Should a round of applause for calling everyone small group primates. An excellent trick. Nish.
Hello. To be absolutely clear, let me just deal with the elephant in the room. I don't know what I'm doing here either. It's increasingly unclear to me why I am here. I am a stand-up comedian. I'm now following two academics and speaking into a microphone I've genuinely only seen in public inquiries. Like, literally, the only time I see this microphone is when people are talking about where the WMDs were in Iraq. Like, I'm a stand-up comedian and I do a political podcast. I'm as confused as you are, like, in general terms. I mean, I think there's a real information crisis. I mean, people keep talking about polarisation. I don't think that the problem is... I think the problem of polarisation is secondary to the problem that we no longer operate from a shared set of facts, right? That's sort of the issue. There was a measles outbreak in North London 3 months ago because we can no longer agree that vaccination is the best way to protect our children from that specific disease. You know, before we can sort of have... yeah, somebody's already heckling. Jesus Christ. Listen, all I'm saying is, the first crisis we have to solve is the crisis of lack of shared information. I understand that the government is attempting to take action on this, and they are banning under-16s from social media, right? And that's sort of supposed to have a dual benefit of improving social cohesion, and also it has the benefit of dealing with the crisis in children's mental health care. I do just want to add, if you are banning under-16s from mobile phones for the benefit of society, you have to, and I'm sorry to quite a lot of people in this room, take the phones off the old people.
Yes.
If you really, like, I'm actually not in favour of a ban in any direction, but if you're taking phones off anybody, it's got to be the old people first, right? And it is over 50s. I'm sorry to say that. I can feel the hackles of Generation X being raised, but I'm afraid to say I don't think we should take mobile phones off anybody, right? I think that's actually a cowardly way out in terms of legislation. If you actually wanted to deal with the root cause of the problem, you would legislate tech companies, right? You would regulate tech companies. Tech companies and social media platforms in particular should be regulated as publishers because they have been operating from a profit basis as publishers. They hollowed out the entire of the news media industry in this country and across the world because they pretended the entire time they didn't need to be regulated by publishers. But in reality, they are publishers and they should be regulated as such. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen, okay, because we are scared of capital, and so our governments will not move against it. So they've banned under 16s from going on their phone. Okay, fine. If you're not going to do the thing that will help, and you're going to ban people from phones, everyone under 16, no phones. Everyone over 50, no phones. That will deal with some of the problems. We could maybe work out a sort of PG-13 style compromise where a 57-year-old is able to use their phone if they're being supervised by a 23-year-old. Maybe it's one of those things.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hey, I'm not saying that any generation is more inherently virtuous than any other generation. I'm firmly of the belief that every generation is 50%, a word I'm not allowed to say on the stage, and 50% non, a word I'm not allowed to say on this stage. It's just my contention that the 50% word I'm not allowed to say on this stage in the kind of Generation X and the sort of baby boomer generation, the two generations above us, have sort of overwhelmed their decent counterparts and have now become the kind of driving force. If you look at the electoral forces that are moving around Nigel Farage and that have moved around Donald Trump, they are very often people from the baby boomer generation. Generation X, I'm sorry to say, I know you think you're cool, you're not. 50% of you are fine. The other 50% are some of the worst people humanity has ever produced. And I understand that there's some residual tension in the room, and I probably should have warned you from the beginning, I was a university debater, which is a polite way of saying old virgin. And I would offer as rebuttal to anyone, sorry, to the university debaters, but I am right. I would offer as rebuttal from Generation X, Ricky Gervais, Dave Chappelle, J.K. Rowling and Elon Musk. So there are these are all people from Generation X whose brains were ruined because they had too much exposure to Twitter and now they've gone mad, right? So if you want to save the world, we can either do the actual thing that would help us, which is regulate the tech sector. And if you're not going to do that, and if you're going to take the coward's way out, take the phones off the under 16s and the over 50s, and let's start moving towards a kind of solution here. I would say the thing that we also need to really bear in mind is Gen Z, sorry, straight off the bat, let's get the apologies in. I don't like it when comedians make fun of Gen Z because you're so... sorry about that. People keep saying that people your age aren't drinking anymore. I'm like, yeah, good. They need to learn how to fight in the water war. So I'm pleased that you're embracing sobriety and maybe learning Brazilian jiu-jitsu or whatever it is. People my age need to stop saying things like the children will save us. People my age, the millennials, we very much are moving in to the positions of political leadership. And that is bad because we're all to a man. Morons. But yeah, we need to be ready for an era of political leadership. And more broadly, I would say the four things we really need to do are, number one, most importantly, wrestle control of the systems by which we communicate with each other from the tech sector, right? That's absolutely the most important thing. These guys have already spoken in much more qualified terms and without so many F-bombs about why that's important, right? We need to wrestle control back of the tech sector. We probably should have known that they were bad actors because they identified themselves as disruptors. And that is not a positive thing. If I went to the supermarket and brandished my genitals in the vegetable aisle, that would be considered extremely, not extremely, just moderate to below average disruptive, but it disruptive nonetheless. We also need to, and this is maybe more of an abstract point, we need to end our fascination with hypocrisy, right? I understand why we're compelled by this idea that people in their personal or public lives can't live up to the values that they are simultaneously espousing. And I do understand that that is bad. But I would argue it's worse to just be unpleasant all of the time. You know, I'm not defending Angela Rayner, but I'm asking you to take as an example the way that she has been treated by our political and media class. So it turns out that she, HMRC has cleared it as the lowest possible offence at the time that I'm speaking to you right now. But initially, she was deemed to have not paid, I think, £40,000 in stamp due as part of the purchase of a flat. And now, obviously, at the time, everybody was very furious. She's a Labour Prime Minister. She's advocating for people to take their tax more often. She's failed to live up to the values that she's been espousing in public. Now, the only thing that I would say is Nigel Farage, the man who still leads a lot of polls as the person who's going to be the next Prime Minister of this country, through a similar tax avoidance scheme, avoided paying stamp duty of around £44,000. He also received £5 million from Christopher Harborne, a Thailand-based cryptocurrency billionaire. Why he received that money, it remains unclear. Whether it's tied to any kind of a specific formal political donation still remains opaque. But the problem is that when you raise that with people, people say, well, he's like this all the time, he's consistent. I'm just saying... We need to make it less bad to be a hypocrite than just to always be a piece of it. I know that sounds like quite a simple move, but I think it would genuinely help us. The third thing we need to do is we need to act against capital, because at this point, capital has overwhelmed our systems of democracy. It feels sometimes like our governments no longer serve their voters, but they serve only the interests of capital. And that is a crisis that infects almost every aspect of our lives. We can't regulate the tech sector because those companies are too powerful. We can't act against fossil fuel producers who have essentially been behaving like big tobacco in terms of the fact that they knew the damage that their products were causing and proceeded to continue selling them to us all anyway. BP hired Ogilvy and Mather, the advertising agency. You all know this, but they hired an advertising agency to create the idea of a carbon footprint. So the responsibility for dealing with the climate crisis would be passed on to individuals rather than the fossil fuel industry that has been profiting from it from all of these years. So it's very important that we deal with capital, right? It's very important that we act against that at a governmental level. And the fourth most important thing is that it's very important, and I know that this is going to be a bit hypocritical after all of the moaning I've just done, but not to lose hope, right? And I don't have anything pat to say to you. I don't have anything reassuring here. I want to say when we act together, we can fight, we can win this. I don't know if we can win this, but that isn't a reason to stop fighting, right? You weren't fighting this fight because you thought you could win. You were fighting it because it was the right thing to do. And if you're in this room, I keep saying this every time I'm requested to speak in a manner that I'm simply unqualified to do. I keep saying the same thing to people. If you are in this room right now and you are a woman, a person of colour, an immigrant or the child of immigrants, a member of the LGBTQIA community, a physically disabled person or somebody who is working class or comes from a working class background, then the only reason you are sat in this room right now is because people fought and died for your right to be here. I'm not saying we can't give up because there's some abstract goal that we might be able to achieve. I'm saying you can't give up because you owe it to too many people that have given their blood and in some cases given their lives to drag us to this point of progress. 2 years ago at the Edinburgh Book Festival, I saw the American writer Ta-Nehisi Coates be asked about why he still continues to write and why he still continues to talk about politics and talk about issues like the genocide in Gaza and raise those kind of issues. Why is he still pushing himself forward in this way? And he said simply, I've got debts to pay. And he talked about the legacy of slavery and the legacy of the civil rights movement that he feels that he is operating as a direct consequence of, right? And so you can't give up. I don't know if we're going to win, but we all have debts to pay. Thank you. I just also want to say the only thing that I've written here is I am just pretending to write so I don't look like a Dumbo. And then I have underlined Dumbo.
Nish, I think you've shown us exactly why you're here, right? And also, thank you for keeping it clean. That was
I didn't say once, okay? I don't think I've been given enough credit for that.
It's going to go. I have tenure. Well, Alex, look, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, right? So you have this wonderful... you have a wonderful comedy act where you talk about the similarities between you and Rishi Sunak, which got me thinking, like, what is it which can bring us together? How can comedy bring us together in a way which in a good way? I'll ask that, and then I'll ask about psychology and so you know social media for these guys.
You're potentially talking to Britain's most divisive comedian, a man who's sort of monetized leftist disgruntlement. I think there are sort of interesting... There are ways in which comedy has brought us together. I would say one of the most sort of unifying things I've ever been part of is the TV show Taskmaster, which does seem to sort of have a fan base that kind of transcends geographical or generational or ethnic or religious boundaries. So there are definitely instances where I think comedy can... There are apolitical instances where I think comedy can provide platforms where people with different viewpoints can actually have moments of shared humanity, because it doesn't matter what political background you come from, Greg Davis is funny. He's just really tall and he looks like bad, and that's funny. But there are also, I think, ways in which... Listen, there are ways in which comedy can change the world for the worse and ways that it can do it for the better. Because I've spent the last 10 years being asked, do you think comedy can change the world? And I've always said no. And then a group of American comedians turned podcasters picked the current president of the United States of America. You know, they became part of a laundering system for fascistic political ideas. And they did that for profit. You know, Joe Rogan, Andrew Schultz. I know everybody's not expecting me to name names. I'll name names. Joe Rogan, Andrew Schultz in this country, Jimmy Carr, has become a kind of part of a laundry system for fascist and crypto-fascist ideologies. So clearly it can change the world. It could be for the worse. I've always felt the best thing that I can do in terms of doing comedy about serious subjects, I don't think I'm changing anybody's mind based on the people that come to see me, but I do think all I'm trying to do in those moments is kind of take the issues that people like you who are working in areas that might actually engineer genuine, meaningful political and social change, is to give you a moment of respite by laughing about the issues that you think seriously about every single day. Like, that's the most useful service I think I provide, is giving you people a break so that you can re-energise yourselves and go back to actually doing things that might benefit all of us as a species.
Thank you.
Can I comment on that? So I also completely agree with Neil that, like, it makes complete sense to me that you're here. And what you were saying about humour being able to connect with people and provide that relief, there's actually some research out there that totally supports that. So some people think that humor developed as a bonding mechanism, and that laughter specifically developed as this involuntary expression of the recognition of the same sort of thinking, the same thought, the same sort of patterns in our minds. And it allows you then to realize, like, when someone else thinks the same thing that's funny that you do, like, Nish has a Lisa Simpson phone case from a very specific episode.
Yes, I am a parody of myself.
And I love this episode of The Simpsons.
Summer of 4'2".
where she's like, yeah, you know, cool, like, whatever.
It's great.
And that, you know, that sort of, that similar recognition of the same way of thinking is a really, really basic level of human bonding. So someone, you know, we've been talking with the social media team beforehand, and they've been asking people throughout the week, like, how to save the planet. Everyone keeps coming back to cooperation, but don't always have sort of explanations of, like, how do we enable that cooperation. Humor is actually a big part of that, I think. It just is, it's a cheat code to bonding.
Great. Thank you. Nick?
Well, actually, that point you just made about resonating is really important, because, and I think it's one of the roots to how we solve the social media problem, because the moment we've designed social media so they just become echo chambers. Stuff is just thrown at us, it bounces off the wall, we jump up and down, that leads to money being taken. I'll come back to capital in a minute because that's crucial. But actually, much better is resonating with people. You can do that whether you're in the same room or not. You can do that across a whole country, because you know your values, you know what you're trying to say. You just need a connective structure that somehow puts you in sync with people. You don't need a machine to throw stuff at you in a certain way. That's what we developed. It's completely the wrong design for social media. But I do think this goes back to the point about capital, and I want to emphasize this, because we haven't mentioned AI yet, but I actually think we are approaching what Marx would have loved to see, an actual contradiction in capitalism, the chasm opening up in front of us as people lose the idea they might even have a job. People told they have to code 5 years ago, now told, well, coding is so passe, the AI has already done what you just trained to do. And I think this is a genuine contradiction of capitalism. And for me, I see confronting the social media mess as almost a preparation for this much bigger fight, which is confronting the damage that AI is going to do to the environment, And that basically extractive capitalism is going to do to everything, the social environment and the physical environment. I think we now have to start facing that. And we're certainly going to need some humour in order to, for that fight, that's for sure. But we also have to see really clearly where we need to be going. And I think I'm not without hope, because I think people are increasingly seeing this is the bigger battle. I sit up and take notice when the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch, talks about, uses the word rebellion. I jumped for joy when they said that. They said the American AI rebellion is building. Ah, they get it. Finally, they're starting to notice. That could be a sign of hope for me. A rebellion, I think, is building.
Wonderful. I'm going to open it up for questions from the room, first of all. So we'll go to questions from the audience. I have some online. If you're online, please type short questions in the Q&A box. We'll answer as many as possible. For those of you in the room, raise your hand. People with microphones will come and find you. As ever, if you could make sure that there is a question there, that would be really handy. And sort of, it's nice if you introduce yourself, but briefly rather than any sort of, you know, biographies, if that is okay. We'll go with this person, glasses here. So I've just made your life as hard as possible. Let's go here and then there. So that's okay, make things a bit easier.
Good evening. So firstly, thank you all very much for the talk. And Nish, you mentioned how fossil fuel companies had been using advertising campaigns to improve their image. Do you think, to any of you, do you think there are effective tactics in advertising and publicity that environmental groups can use to combat that? Thank you very much.
Okay, and then we'll go here. I'll take a few, and then you can ignore the ones you don't want to answer.
Hi, I'm an alumni, postgrad and undergrad of the LSE. Just a quick, well, it's not a quick question, sorry. Just referring to the toxicity that Nick referred to, I think it's there in national institutions as well, and can there be any hope when it's there, when there's institutional oppression of people of particularly outstanding people of colour who speak up. And I want to give a quick example of someone who did fight and die to save. She was a senior doctor. She was the first doctor or a senior consultant of colour in her specialism. She was tackling health inequalities in the NHS. She was an NHS consultant. She was voted vice president of her specialism in the whole country by all the doctors of the country. She was suing her hospital for racism and discrimination. She was a national trailblazer. She was a mentor of an Afro-Caribbean Doctors Association. And she gave a landmark lecture in inequality in health outcomes for people of colour at the Royal College of Physicians. She walked into a hospital, the London Marsden Hospital, on the 14th of March and died within 14 days. She was my sister. She was a very, very senior doctor. And she pleaded to leave. She asked for treatment. She was not given treatment. To date, the Marsden haven't even replied to my request for an investigation.
Okay.
They haven't given any medical records. And I'm just, I mean, I'm astounded. I'm normally a quiet person, but I'm just saying these institutional oppression of people of colour is one of the biggest problems we have in this country. And it's not just in the corporate sector and the media. It's
okay.
Everywhere.
Thank you. I mean, I think we all have huge sympathy and, you know, very sorry about that. And then if we'll take one more question, we'll take this one here. That's okay.
So just a comment.
And could you introduce yourself as well, please?
Yes, alumni 1994.
And your name?
Jaya.
Okay.
Hope that we're here, that's hope, because we're here and we're having the conversation. Education is my question. What role do all the panel members think education plays solving this crisis? Because for me, I think that's got to be part of the answer.
Okay, fantastic. Do you guys think who wants to start?
I'm happy to jump in on the first question. So correct me if I'm wrong, the question is sort of how can environmental groups use marketing ideas, right? I think it's a great question, first of all. And definitely just in terms of recognizing that we can really think through this and be strategic about the way that we're communicating from every side of the political spectrum. And I wanted to give one example of where I think the environmental movement has done an amazing job to do this, and that's in the framing of the Green New Deal. So most people will be familiar with that phrase on some level, but a few years, I think the history of it is it did start as a term here in the UK with a small group of people. But it references the New Deal from the U.S., Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1920s, did this massive work program, this sort of like, it wasn't just about welfare, it was about like giving people like jobs and dignity and giving them the chance to change their own lives, and but really investing that in a massive way that reached tons and tons and tons of people and frankly transformed the physical spaces of the U.S. You can still go to national parks in the U.S. and you see these like beautiful built bridges that the Works Project Administration built. And so it's referencing this specific heritage and history, and it's a really shorthand way to say that a Green New Deal, which a new one for the current challenges, could actually be people-focused in the same way the New Deal was. And you can get that idea of a complex kind of policy agenda across in a really shorthand way by evoking an aspect of the past that brings together ideas that can be packaged in a really clean, coherent way. And then the last thing, can I answer two questions?
Yeah, do, okay? Do go for it.
So what role does education play? Again, a really fantastic question. And I think it's one of the toughest ones that we need to confront as institutions of higher education. I have a very small little like soapbox that I'm obsessed with. It's not, maybe this is the crowd for it actually. I think that there's a lot of things that we teach in higher education that need to be taught much sooner. And the first one is statistics. So students will learn tons of, you know, algebra and even calculus at some point. And I'm not just saying that algebra and calculus aren't super useful, but I am saying that every single person in this room will have read a percentage, a vote intention percentage in a newspaper or online at some point in the last like week or two probably, right? We're bombarded with statistics constantly. We talk about them, we use them as proof points. People use, you know, I said in my remarks, 80% of the British public. Well, what does that really mean? What do you have to do to actually understand what that number means? So as a part of, and I'm interested to hear if Nick has some thoughts on this, of media literacy and introducing aspects of media studies early on in education, there's also just some really basic math that would help people kind of cut through misinformation. I'm very curious to hear about what role sort of a more media literate early education could look like.
Nick.
Okay, well, I don't disagree, but I'm afraid I think a lot of the problems we're dealing with social media toxicity is way beyond literacy. There are images that can come at you online today. You just see them once, your whole life has changed. It's not a matter of literacy. You shouldn't be seeing them. So I think we have to bear that in mind, and that leads to the way I would take education slightly different. The key thing is to be having this open debate. I, at LSE, I'm privileged. I can have a completely open debate with my students. There is no censorship of my courses. I give a very strong line on the, you've heard me talk about issues around capital, and we have that debate. We don't always agree. For me, therefore, the education, the type of education we still have in most universities in the UK, but many are completely corporatized now, but we definitely do not have in American universities now very much. Harvard is about to sack vast numbers of people. Many universities in the US are places where you, every time you open your mouth, you have to be careful in case the thought police are about to monitor what you're doing. This is a serious threat. In this country, that is not the case, and therefore, the way I see universities in a humble way, they're not the necessary to anything, but this is one place where this necessary movement against capital can build. This is one place where people can come together across boundaries. I think we need to open the walls of the university to bring people in and go out from the university to go to other places to talk about the change that's needed. That's the sort of university that I see, and that's the university that LSE has been for 130 years. So I'm glad we're here having this conversation. I think that's what we have to do.
Great, thank you. Nish, do you want to come in?
Yeah, I think education is essential. It's everything. That's absolutely, we need to, you know, we're still counting the cost of the damage done to our country by the first coalition government. Yeah. And the austerity package rolled out by Cameron and Osborne. It, you know, I think just because a lot of the Conservative prime ministers, just because a lot of the prime ministers full stop that have followed them have been more theatrically awful, I don't think we've done enough of an audit of how much damage to our public institutions the first wave of austerity did. So I think, yeah, education funding is absolutely essential. I did a really fun thing called Climate Explained, where Dr. Freddie Otto, who's an actual climate scientist, was talking scientifically about the climate crisis, and then they got a Burke to just speak it in plain English. There are loads of really fun initiatives that are being worked out. I'm really sorry about your sister. That's really awful. And institutional oppression is absolutely something we should be talking about. You know, the way that some higher education facilities police Palestine protests, I think was an absolute disgrace. I think also we just barely started to scratch the surface of the conversation about racism. And in a lot of ways, why would we be further along with it than we are? You know, like, it's only my mum came to this country in 1973, and she was sort of being chased around the streets of Leicester by the National Front. You know, it's worth saying things have improved, right? In the last 50 years, in some ways, they have improved. But in other ways, we barely scratched the surface of the conversation that we need to have about race and racism in this country. You know, we had a Labour Prime Minister give a speech that, whether consciously or otherwise, it's irrelevant really, the intent, but did directly echo the Rivers of Blood speech made by Enoch Powell. That's a problem. We barely scratched the surface of the extent to which the institutions of this country are racist. And in some ways, why would we? Racism is an idea. All forms of prejudice are ideas that are thousands of years old. Why in the second half of the 20th century would we have just wiped the slate clean? That is an unfathomable notion to me. Yeah, of course, there need to be audits for all of our institutions. You know, racist name-calling is terrible, but it's a symptom of institutional racism. And dealing with the name-calling is just surface level. But actually, if you want to properly talk about prejudice and institutional prejudice, that was only a conversation that we were kind of barely scratching the surface of.
Great. It will just take a very quick set of questions. I'm going to take one from online, which is from Neil Mukherjee, who is a conservationist and filmographer. He says, how can we avert a generational divide of them and us? You know, we need to work together to save the planet so the younger generation can't save the planet alone. We'll take one from the front as well. And then
Thank
we'll go
so
to...
Thank you so much. My name is Sindhura. I'm a PhD researcher in the Media and Commons Department. I had a question for all the speakers, Denise, really quickly. I wonder if we are all human in the same way. Are we perceived as all human? And maybe it's a field difference, right? Do you think concepts of racial capitalism, patriarchy, racism do matter when you're talking about how, you know, small group primates, but who is the us and who is the them? And for Nick and Nish, didn't realize it would rhyme, but you're talking about capital, so the role capital has played in perpetuating the genocide in Gaza is also very important for us to discuss, and the genocide is also an ecocide, so I was wondering what you would say about that, and maybe Nish, it would be interesting for you to know that the encampment did take place right here. So, yeah. Fun fact.
Thank you. And then we'll just take the gentleman in the football shirt. And if we can keep it quick, because I'm not sharing very well.
Tyler, I'm a master's student in social and cultural psychology right now. You've all talked about how we need to cooperate better. I'm curious in the sense of the UK as a whole, is it better that all the nations are together? When you look at Wales, that is, voted for a Socialist Party for over 105 years, have a Nation of Sanctuary Act, Future Generations Act, and they were in my dissertation finding that Plaid Cymru voters are rejecting nostalgia, not being nostalgic for a past. So is England just dragging them all behind?
Okay, that's a great question. Let's finish there. Guys, we don't have too long, so I don't know who wants to go first. Nick, do you want to?
All right, on the last one, Great Britain is a colonial project. So we have to recognise that. That's what it is. Scotland was a colony until it's fought. Wales, Ireland, in fact, Northern Ireland, was the very first use of the word plantation was in Northern Ireland, the first colony. So that's to be resolved, and it comes back to the point we can't deal with issues such as racism unless we profoundly engage with colonial history. I spent the past 10 years of my work working on the idea of data colonialism. So that finally say a bit more about ecocide. We haven't talked about it, but of course there is a profound economic damage done by the very same tech we're talking about. So it's particularly obvious to us all today in relation to AI because the abuse is so extreme. So the next five big data centers in Scotland are going to use as much energy in a week or two as Scotland uses through the whole winter. This is just mind-blowingly crazy, unless you believe in the goal, which is what corporates want to do, which is extraction. So we have to challenge that. Basically, the AI civilization we're building, which is infused already into social media, so it's intensifying it even further, so the two have to be seen together, is environmentally unsustainable, and as we've also seen, socially unsustainable. So unless we face it head on, as we said.
Denise.
Sorry to cite you there. But I do believe in citation.
Now I'm the square that's not cussing. On intergenerational solidarity and sort of not creating an us versus them mentality between generations, I have a lot of hope in this, actually. So there's quite a strong percentage of people in older generations who are really worried about younger generations. I'd say right now that there isn't a real us versus them mentality between young people and old people. Instead, there's sort of a divide between the ways that what type of solutions do we think actually will help young people? Which leads me to the next question of, like, are we all human in the same way? Some ways absolutely not. So we didn't touch on this a lot tonight, but one of the biggest things driving polarization is our difference, our fundamental, strong, core ideological differences in the way that we think our groups should be organized. So yes, we're all members of groups, but we have different and really, really strong ideas about whether or not groups should have very, very strict rules and laws, or whether we should be a little bit more lenient and forgiving and have mercy. Whether we should be organizing power and resources in an equal flat way, or whether there should be a hierarchy in the way that we're distributing resources and power. So those are really big differences between us that drive us apart into polls. And then lastly, I'll just challenge one idea, and I think it's the aspect of your question I'm most qualified to answer, which is that the idea of, like, a left-wing party like Plaid Cymru, like their voters rejecting nostalgia. I would challenge that. So there are different forms of nostalgia, and tonight I think we've really, like, touched quite a bit on one of my favorite forms, which is a nostalgia for progress and a nostalgia for innovation. And in that way, we often think of ourselves, especially in places like this, as the sort of inheritors of these trailblazers. And the people who really paved the way and challenged systems. And that type of nostalgia is very linked with left-wing voting, actually. And it also can be very, very mobilizing. So there's, I think that, you know, obviously at events like this, people always say, like, how do we answer the question at hand? We have more events like this. But I do want to go back to a point that Nick made about the lack of open debate and the true necessity of that. Because it allows us to have a quick touch and see what makes people laugh, see what makes people go, you know, where are we finding that quick little connection? And tonight for me, one of the things that I've heard really loud and clear is that importance of recognizing those who have come before us to trailblaze to where we are today.
Fantastic. Nish, final word.
Oh, God. generational divide, yeah, massive problem, massive generational inequality economically. I will say that one of the, like, nice things about doing the style of comedy that I've done in the last few years is that there isn't really, like, a type of person... Sorry, there is a type of person that comes to see me, but that is not bound by age or ethnicity or sexual orientation. It's just I've always said this, it's a group of people who either have a Guardian or New York Times subscription or recently cancelled those subscriptions because the papers were insufficiently left-wing. Like, that's sort of the type. And I do genuinely see from, like, agitated-looking 14-year-olds to a man who was in his 70s and at a show of mine in Birmingham in 2023 was wearing a T-shirt that said, I still hate Margaret Thatcher, and she had been dead for a decade, okay? So, like, I do see a lot of intergenerational solidarity, which we're going to need to overcome the massive intergenerational economic inequality that my generation has been confronted with and then is now worsened for Gen Z and is probably going to worsen for Gen Alpha as well. So that intergenerational solidarity is really important. The UK, I felt very sorry for Scotland, right? Like, they voted to remain part of the United Kingdom, and then in the Brexit vote, which Scotland as a country voted to remain part of the European Union, we fundamentally changed the terms of being in the UK. Like, I think it's difficult to deny, regardless of how you feel about Scottish independence, it's very difficult to deny that purely on a basis that we change the terms of the membership of the UK, that they deserve a second referendum. Like, that is a really hard thing. Again, I'm not taking a side either way on Scottish independence, I'm just saying. But I do think that there are points, problems, because England sometimes is trapped in a toxic nostalgia that maybe other countries are free of because we're not, you know, they weren't the epicentre of the colonial power. I hope we're all human in the same way, but we are the byproduct of racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, we're popular, the products of systems. And so those systems leave us with prejudices, and they leave us, for some of us, with systemic disadvantages. And acknowledging that systemic disadvantage does not denigrate the humanity of people who might have benefited from it. You know, that it's just part of having an open and honest conversation. And I'm really glad that you talked about positive nostalgia, because, like, I do think about this all the time, right? That I sometimes think that we are patriotic in this country about the wrong things. Like, we're fixated on the wrong. We could be talking about the idea that in the sort of out of the ashes of World War II, four working class kids from Liverpool, because they were able to go to art school for free, met each other, formed a band, and if we must reduce everything to pounds and pence, that band has put so much more into the coffers of this country than their education ever took out. The Beatles are a hugely positive story about systemic success in the United Kingdom. And I know that it was more complicated than this, and it's not as straightforward as how I'm about to present it. But the simple fact is that one day in this country, everybody woke up and had access to free healthcare at the point of delivery, regardless of their economic circumstances. That is a political miracle, right? And if I just have to believe, if we were able to pull off a political miracle once, then surely we can do it again. Like, that, yeah, that's the end.
Fantastic. Now, just in a moment, we will be able to go over there and have a drink. And you can buy a copy of Nick's latest book and get it signed. But we need to sort of recognise the work which has gone into the LSE Festival from quite a large number of people. So I'm going to sort of run through some teams, some groups of people who've done a huge amount of work and worked really hard this week. And if we could just give them very short rounds of applause, sorry, to because of my chairing. So first of all, the stewards. The security. They're not here, but the cleaners. The AV team. The estates team. LSE catering. The comms division. In particular, Louise Jones and Tigany as well. Sort of fantastic work there. Thank you. All of our speakers and events organisers. Here's like the ego one. You guys for being the audience. It's a bit sickening. And last of all, our three brilliant speakers tonight.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.